I found that as the months passed, it became more and more distant from me, that I felt this odd feeling that I'd lost the book and I'd lost the sense of the person who had created the book. You know, something wonderful would happen with the book, some great review or win a prize, and it was wonderful, but I always felt, oh, I wish I could tell the Tom who wrote the book, because this Tom, somehow he's become used to the idea that he has a book in the world.
That was the novelist Tom Crewe, and here I am back with a new episode of In Writing, so thank you for joining me. Tom is the author of The New Life, which came out at the beginning of last year. And we're going to get into the subject matter of the novel a bit more during the episode, but it was inspired by a group of academics in the late 19th century who were in favour of a more progressive and tolerant attitude to sexuality. And then along came the Oscar Wilde trial, which kind of derailed the whole thing. And in the novel, that becomes a serious setback. I read The New Life when I was part of a judging panel on the Nero Book Awards last year. And I just remember thinking that Tom's writing was dazzling. He's also a contributing editor of the London Review of Books, and last year he was on Granta's Best of Young British Novelists list, which is a very big deal because they only do it once a decade. It was so nice to go and visit Tom at his office. It's a rented space on a very pretty street in North London, and he has quite a small room in quite an old-fashioned building with a lot of character. Tom is, I would say, a very literary and intellectual person and somebody who thinks very deeply about his writing process, which was so interesting to hear about. In this episode, he talks about his patience in the slow process of writing a novel, how working as an editor at the London Review of Books has made him better at editing his own work, and why he thinks that sex scenes are a key part of depicting human life, and lots, lots more. We also have a good conversation about the strange emotions around publishing a book. We recorded this in September, and I was listening back to it. I was surprised to hear myself mention how weird I was feeling at that point about my own book coming out, which was still 2 months off. It was interesting to listen back to that and remember how it felt just waiting for publication day. Before we get started, a quick word about Curtis Brown Creative, the renowned writing school run by the Literary and Talent Agency. I'm very happy that they're sponsoring this season of the podcast. If you have an idea for a novel but you don't know how to get started, join their 6-week online Starting to Write Your Novel course. Curtis Brown Creative also run a wide variety of courses focused on different genres, from romance fiction to psychological thrillers. So there's something on offer for every type of writer. If you're looking for a unique present this festive season, check out their gift vouchers. A writing course voucher will make the perfect practical and inspiring gift for the creative spirit in your life. And they're available from just £40. Curtis Brown Creative have also provided an exclusive discount for In Writing listeners on Starting to Write Your Novel or any other 4 or 6 week online course. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off and visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. Now, over to Tom.
Well, this room was... it was a sort of COVID byproduct, in the sense that I moved in with my boyfriend and I had nowhere to put my books and nowhere to work. And we found this office together. So it was the first time ever in my life I'd had my own space to work. I'd always been working at the end of a table, or in the winter I used to carry a garden table up from the garden into my bedroom to work on. So I'd always been sort of having improvisational surroundings, and this was my first proper office, so I felt very grown up.
Would you describe it for people listening?
Well, it's quite a small room. It's I put in a lot of sort of IKEA bookcases, so it's got, I would imagine, thousands of books in here now.
It's almost more book than space.
Yes, I mean, it's I've sort of ruined it for myself. It's very hard to move around. I can't sit on the lovely chaise longue I installed here. I tend to spend my time laughing at how ridiculously crowded it is. But this contains basically all my 20th century novels. I have novels from all other periods at home, and here I have everything from about 1930 onwards, and then some history books as well. So it sort of has a special character. It has a certain kind of book in here, which gives it an identity.
Yeah, it's got a lovely feeling to it. I mean, it is like being in a sort of tiny library.
Yes, and I did always want to have my own library. I should probably say maybe more interesting is that I have something approaching a kind of gallery of literary heroes. So I have a framed portrait of Henry James as a young man, because it seemed important to me to not be intimidated by Henry James the old man, and to feel like everyone starts somewhere. And I have a picture of Virginia Woolf. I have a portrait of George Meredith, who's probably no one's literary hero apart from mine, and quite a few pictures of Trollope, who's another hero, and some encouraging quotations from writers. These ones are mainly to do with character as related to plot, which is something I'm always interested in.
Would you read us one of the quotes on the wall? Which, by the way, you've written on sort of lined notebook paper and then blue tacked up there.
That's right. Well, one I really like is from Trollope. It's from his autobiography. And it goes like this. "And as here in our outer world, we know that men and women change, become worse or better as temptation or conscience may guide them, so should these creations of his," that is the novelist, "so should these creations of his change, and every change should be noted by him. On the last day of each month recorded, every person should be a month older than on the first."
Well, that's very good. So that's just a reminder that characters, like humans, evolve.
That's right.
Yeah.
I think when I started writing my new novel, I was very interested in trying to let the characters lead in some way that it's odd because I sort of let my characters lead, or I thought I did in my first novel, but I had a strong sense of trying to give my characters more leeway, more time to sort of evolve and bump into each other and create circumstances that way. So I've been trying to hold on to that idea.
And then you really do have books, I mean, all over the desk. Your laptop is on top of some books.
Yep.
And piles of books under the desk and all around the floor. You've done a lovely job of tidying it up. Yes, to make room for me.
This is the tidy version. Yeah.
I know. Well, I mean, it is very, there's something very pleasing about it, but it is also a bit overwhelming. Do you ever think, I'm going to have to get rid of some of these?
I find it very hard to give away books. I don't really know why. Or rather, it is that I buy so many books. I'm completely addicted to buying secondhand books, so I hardly ever buy new books. So I think when you buy as many books as I do, your library, such as it is constantly prospective. It's always prospective. So I never really get to the point where I think, oh, there's so many here that need to be thrown away or given away because I've read them. Because so much is I'm constantly expanding my potential reading. So it seems much always more of an invitation than a record, if that makes sense.
Yeah. What percentage of these do you think you've read?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't know. Maybe, probably, if I'm being completely honest, maybe 30%?
I think that's still pretty good. I mean, there are literally thousands of books in here. So, okay. Well, it's a really lovely, lovely space. And you said that are you still working on your second novel, or have you wrapped that now?
If only I had wrapped it. No, I'm very much still working on it with no end in sight, sadly.
Are you writing, is it a kind of drafts system that you work on, or are you still on the first draft, or are you doing edits? Or?
Well, I'm one of those writers who is sort of bemused by the idea of drafts. I physically can't imagine, or physically is the wrong word, I can't imagine writing drafts, if that means sort of successively different versions of the same book. I'm constantly stopping and starting, and I'm in a constant state of revision. So for me, the book is a constant negotiation until the moment when it's finished, at which point then there will presumably be a whole set of revisions which are based on the book being a finished product. But that wouldn't, to me, look like another draft. It would look like a sort of major editing process. Yeah.
So how long have you been working on this one?
Since the beginning of 2022. January 2022.
Okay. And so, does it have all its bits? Does it have an ending? Does it?
No. It has not. It's going to be a long book, it seems to me. So even though I'm working at a good pace and feel like I'm achieving things every week and I'm not at all stuck, it's just
just takes time.
It's just taking time. It's going to take longer than the first book or something. It's I mean, that's part of its challenge. It's part of its appeal to me. I wanted to write something quite different from my first book, and it has length built into it somehow.
Mm-hmm. How do you approach work kind of day to day? You said that you feel like you are making progress every week. How do you measure that?
Well, definitely not in terms of words. It's normally a feeling of maybe having finished a chapter or having solved a problem or had a set of good ideas that I can put into action the next week. I mean, obviously you hope to have written some words. I wrote my first book while working full time and doing a lot of other writing, so I got into the habit. I remember the moment when I realized I would have to do this, the painful moment I realized I would have to do it, but I got into the habit of doing at least an hour of work before breakfast, before I went to work. And I still like to do an hour before breakfast. That's the kind of fixed element in my routine.
What time's breakfast?
Well, I mean, I'm lucky that I don't need to dash off to the office anymore, so I probably now I'm starting work around 8 and having breakfast around 9. But it's something about not eating. It's something about postponing eating adds some encouragement to getting through the work, and definitely a feeling of, lots of writers say this, but there is something about being up early in the morning and not the day not having made its claims on you yet. And something about eating is already the day making a claim. It's sort of approaching it as pure as you can be.
Yeah. So would you say you're doing kind of an hour a day, 5 days a week? Is that roughly?
Oh, no. So now I no longer work full time. So I have a much more flexible schedule, and I still do some work for the London Review of Books, but I'm able now to do at least 3 hours a day of writing. So I tend to do this first hour, which still feels like the most crucial hour. It normally feels like my best work is done in that hour. And then I will aim to... normally I will then work on the novel till lunchtime and then get on with my other things. It normally feels like I've exhausted my most fruitful phase by lunch.
Yeah, I find getting things done in the afternoon is a real slog, actually.
Yeah. Don't tell that to the LRB, but that's when I'm doing my work for them.
When was it first clear to you that writing was the thing you were going to pursue with your life?
I mean, if you can say clear, I always wanted to be a writer from being a tiny child. Some of my earliest memories are of sitting with a notepad and writing stories. And I always, all through school, I always said the thing I wanted to do when I grew up was be an author. That's probably quite sad. But it's...
Well, that's not sad. Why is that sad?
I don't know. Yes. So it's a funny thing, because it's just the thing I always wanted to do. And I had a strange confidence that somehow I would do it. It became less clear to me in some ways later on about how it would work. And I went through a phase of thinking I would be an academic historian and write history books, and that was the kind of writer I would be, after always assuming I would be a writer of fiction. And then I changed my mind again and thought, no, I want to write novels. But at that point, it was I was just finishing my PhD, and I had no idea how I was going to become a writer of novels, because in the meantime, I needed to get a job. So it was, it did become quite murky at that point.
Yeah. So you did a PhD in 19th century British history, is that right? I don't have a PhD. I have heard that doing a PhD is sort of equivalent to writing a book. Did it, as somebody who's done both, does it feel like a similar process, or is that a bad analogy?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, a PhD is, I think it depends on what kind of, I mean, obviously there are thousands and millions of ways to do a PhD, but I think sometimes you can have a very specific research question and it can be quite narrow, or you can have a very clear problem you want to solve, or a question you want to answer. And I ended up having actually a very broad set of interests or ambitions, and in that way my PhD felt similar to writing a novel, in the sense that I started really with no idea what I was doing, apart from a sort of vague impulse in a certain direction. And then it was a kind of great intellectual effort to try and summon something out of nothing, to kind of grasp at the universe and trying to drag something into your net. I think in the end that the PhD felt easier than a novel, if that's a fair comparison, if only because a PhD, at least once you started looking in certain directions, you could find facts, find arguments to help you or to spar with. You know, you could, as a historian, you could pile up your evidence and look at the evidence and start trying to shape it into a pattern. But I remember thinking, while writing the novel, this is much, much harder, because there's nothing tangible there. You can't go out and find the facts and find the evidence, and or I felt that I couldn't. I actually was working with a set of historical facts while writing my novel, but they were so few, really. They were just more sort of milestones, and I just remember thinking, God, there's so much empty space here that I need to fill with my imagination, and that's the only place this is going to come from, is my imagination. And that is very challenging. It's part of the thrill, but it's a huge challenge to create the structure of a book, to track a set of evolutions in plot and character in your mind, without much help from the outside world.
It's too much freedom, really, and not enough constraints.
Yes.
Or having to maybe create your own constraints of what it's going to be and what it isn't going
to
be.
Yes. I used to say that it, sort of writing a PhD or writing essays for the LRB, which I do, I used to think that it was like going down a mountain, but beforehand you could plot out your, I've never skied, but I sort of imagine skiing, like you plot out your route down the mountain with your bits of evidence and your arguments, and you sort of, then it's quite, you know, hair-raising trying to get down to the bottom, but you've at least got a path to follow. You've set out your markers. But a novel is much more like rolling down the mountain and picking up snow as you go, gathering momentum and gathering density, and bouncing off trees and rocks and bloodying yourself and maybe pausing and then rolling off again.
That is actually what it was like when I went skiing, so maybe the two are more similar.
Yeah.
But let's talk just briefly about the essays that you do for the London Review of Books. What is the I was listening to a podcast, must have been the LRB podcast, where you read your essay about your love of wrestling when you were a child, which was so good. Really recommend that. I'll put that in the show notes in case anybody else wants to listen to it. But what is the kind of craft of an LRB piece?
Well, I remember when I was doing my PhD, I was a subscriber to the LRB, and I remember thinking longingly of what a wonderful form it looked like, how much I would love to write in that way, because it combines elements of the academic essay or article. You know, it can be serious, it can be making serious arguments, making a case, but it has much more regard for style, for the giving of pleasure, aesthetic pleasure. It can try to be funny. It should hopefully aspire to be witty. And it's much more of an artistic product, I suppose. You know, you're working within the essay form as practiced by Johnson and The Spectator and Hazlitt and whoever. You're drawing on De Quincey, you're drawing on the heritage of the essay, and it's a wonderful form, very flexible form to work in. You can experiment with pace, structure. You can try, and it's much more enjoyable to write in that way than it is to write in the academic form, even though it can achieve many of the same ambitions and yet offer so much more enjoyment, both as the person writing it and as the person reading it.
How long is an LRB essay usually?
It can range between about 2,000 words, and I think the longest essay that LRB has ever published is around 60,000 words, so which really is a short book. But I've tended always to write between, you know, the 3,000 word to 10,000 word mark most often, though I have written, I think 14,000 words is probably the most I've ever written. But that's something you can play with too. I mean, I like writing short, punchy pieces sometimes, and then having that space to elaborate, not just an argument, but a kind of, to give a sense of a world, give a sense of a individual's character, their milieu, to explore an artist's career, for example. I think there's the pressure not just to arrive at conclusions, but to kind of seed pleasure and interest and information all the way along an essay, which again I think is more characteristic of the kind of classic English essay as practiced by the LRB, that the getting there is just as interesting as the conclusion, if there has to be one.
And you edit other people's essays. Do you think that has made you a better editor of your own work?
Definitely. I think it makes you, if as I have, you've spent nearly 10 years editing other people's writing, it makes you very, I think, quick and decisive. It can make you very sharp. It makes you impatient with, maybe it's what makes me the kind of writer who doesn't plow on and then revise later, because I can't bear to look at my ungainly prose. I always feel the need to intervene early, and I think I definitely just feel practiced. I can sort of see myself moving quickly and decisively. And when I first submitted my book to agents, not to agents, to publishers, and it was bought by Chatto, I went home and immediately took 15,000 words out of the novel. There was something about, I just had that little bit of distance from the novel as I just submitted it, but also I just don't think I could have acted that quickly and confidently if I'd not been an editor myself. I felt professionally qualified to get stuck in, I think.
Do you think that there are, I think that, I work a lot with editors in journalism and have edited myself, and I think that editors often have particular things that bother them, or, you know, that they're very hot on. I remember working with one editor who would always spot if there was a repeated word in too short a space, you know. Do you think there are any particular things that you're very hot on?
I think that depends. I mean, in some ways I'm a different kind of editor of my own work than I am of LRB pieces, because the LRB has a very strong house style and has a very strong sense of what it likes and what it doesn't like, which doesn't necessarily always overlap with my own taste. You know, sometimes I might be inclined to give a writer a bit more of a lead, whereas the classic LRB strategy might be to pull back and to restrain, to insist on restraint. So I think there is a different set of strategies there. You know, I would always know what wasn't a kind of LRB way to open an essay, or not a very LRB way to finish, or a bit too much praise. We don't really like giving writers too much time to praise, because it's, I think the idea is that it's sort of baggy.
It's a bit boring to read.
Yeah, it's boring to read. It's not good prose, just lavishing superlatives on things. But as a novelist, I definitely was probably influenced at an impressionable age by Martin Amis, like many writers. And because of that, I think, you know, definitely repeated words, definitely unintended rhymes. I get very fixated on unintended rhymes that can even be between a, you know, can carry over for many sentences. And I think that right, that somehow I can hear that rhyme in the paragraph.
That's not something that I have ever been aware of. Probably now you've said it, I'll start seeing it everywhere and it'll start irritating me.
You do. And I constantly think, why didn't someone not see that they had one sentence ending no and another ending go? It's just unbearable. So I find that very, very painful. Yeah, just things like, just small things like that, that add up to a general decisiveness, probably.
And what about, do you think that you have any sort of writing tics? Because I was just thinking, I've sort of noticed that I have a bit of a habit of listing things, of going into sentences that are essentially lists, hopefully nice lists, but you don't want loads of lists in a paragraph, unless that's deliberately what you're doing. But are there things that you think that you've perhaps become aware that you tend to do?
Many years ago, someone pointed out to me that I'd written a short story, and the writer Richard Beard it was part of a competition or something, and he critiqued this short story in front of an audience of about 200 people, which was an rather extraordinary experience. And Kazuo Ishiguro was there. So it was sort of like a nightmare experience in some ways. But one of the things he pointed out was that I was very fond of negative formulations. So it's not that, it wasn't that. And I think that's still true. I'm much more conscious of it now, but I do find that for some reason my classic way of framing a kind of paragraph of discussion or reflection is to frame it in terms of negatives. So I am trying to catch myself doing that more. Sometimes you catch yourself doing a kind of rhythm in your prose that you feel like you've done before. The thing I find most commonly, which I think probably afflicts all writers, and sadly not all writers notice it, is that when I sometimes can write some, it's normally dialogue, I write dialogue, and I can look at it and just think there's something really familiar about this. And it's not the words, it's not like that I've sort of lifted words from somewhere else, but I've lifted a dynamic or a rhythm of conversation, which is normally from TV or film. And it's just, it's kind of that sort of archetypal conversation from somewhere else. Mm. And it's sort of like, I don't know, tapping some object and finding it's fake. There's something fake in the dialogue, and I very often write that first, look at it and think, no, that's wrong. Mm. And it could be pages of stuff, but it's the dynamic that's false. It's come from the outside.
Mm. I think there's a funny thing in writing of you don't want things to feel too familiar. You don't want it to feel like it's echoing, yeah, sort of established tone that you've picked up just from the ether. But you also don't want your writing to feel constantly so unfamiliar that it's like jarring and hard work to get through. It's fine line sometimes.
Yes, and you've got, yeah, and you sometimes think, I do always have a reader in mind, as much as I feel I'm writing the book for my own satisfaction, and that I'm writing the book I want to write, and I don't in that sense care whether there's anyone necessarily waiting to read it at the end, because I think books make their own readers to a large extent. But I do always have in mind a reader. I'm always thinking, what will the reader think here? Are they following? Is it clear? I would never use an unfamiliar word at a key moment in a story, in a chapter, in a scene. You can never want to hold a reader up. You never want to stop them in their tracks. You want to carry them with you. I think a lot about structure. I'm really interested in structure and form. How is the best way to tell this story? Where's the variety? Mm. Where's the interest? Where's the surprise?
Well, I was going to come to that. That was on my next page of questions, but let's talk about it now. How did you work out the structure of The New Life?
That really was trial and error. I didn't write with a plan. Some of my reviewers, I think, the story is based on it, is very loosely inspired by historical events, but it's in fact departs from them much more than it follows them. And sometimes reviewers seem to suggest that I was sort of writing up a series of events, but all the events in the book, apart from the Oscar Wilde trial, are invented. So I wrote with a very vague sense that I needed to have these two men write a book about homosexuality, and the book needed to get caught up in the wake of the Oscar Wilde trial, and eventually the book needed to get into its own form of trouble. And that's all I knew. And I wrote for 3 years, just I would finish a chapter and then stop and think, well, what should happen next? But what I had locked myself into was this very rigid alternating perspectives between the two main characters. The story never leaves the perspectives of the characters of John and Henry, and they alternate, the chapters alternate from their perspective, and everything is filtered through their perspective, apart from there are letters between the two men which sort of help bridge the gap until the characters actually meet in the course of the book. So in one sense, I was sort of desperately inventing my way along for years, trying to push the story along and with lots of stopping and starting. But on the other, I actually was, and I felt this much more towards the end of the book, I realized how in some ways limiting this structure I had chosen, this alternating perspectives, was, because it of course put strong limits on the kind of story you can tell. You can only let certain kinds of events in. You can only give characters certain amounts of, other characters certain amounts of space and airtime. You can't go into their heads. You can't. The only way you can bring them onto page is a way that makes sense as seen by John or Henry. It created really quite difficult problems in terms of pacing, because they always had to keep pace with each other, the two stories, and sometimes you really wanted to kind of make a big leap with one character and you found you couldn't. I wanted the chapters had to be roughly the same length. I couldn't give one of them more time than the other. There were things like I ended up having to end the book with Henry, which maybe would not have been my first choice, because that was just the way the order of the chapters had fallen. So I simultaneously had an enormous amount of freedom, a kind of chaotic amount of freedom, and in the end spent a whole year revising the book and sort of breaking it up into different sections and putting them back together again. I simultaneously had all that going on, and at the same time felt ultimately very limited by what I'd done, while seeing that it had productive consequences as well. Sorry, that was a long answer.
No, it's a really interesting answer. It's never going to be perfect. I mean, it is a wonderful book, but I mean, I suppose, yeah, that feeling of like slight dissatisfaction about some of the constraints still produced an excellent book. So when you were doing you were moving things around physically, how did you do that? Was it all on the computer, or were you doing, you know, piles of printouts and moving things around on the floor? And not that you've got very much floor space to do that here, to be honest. But yeah, how did you do it?
Well, I do a lot of writing by hand, so depending on my mood, or more often depending on how stuck I am, I tend to switch between writing by hand and writing on the laptop. If everything's going well on the laptop, I will just happily stay electronic. But the minute I get stuck, or there's something that's just even if it's a phrase I can't work out, or a linking passage, I will immediately switch to my notepad, and that seems to release something, just that bit of change, that change of, I know the writer Patricia Lockwood, she says that one of her tricks is just to change the font on her document, and it gives her that change of perspective. I do that, and then often if things are going well in my notepad, I will then carry on writing in my notepad for a long time until I sort of reach a natural pause, and then I will type up what I've done, and that's a natural period of revision, of course. So I never type up what I've written in my notepad in exactly the same way. I'm always editing it as I go. So I have a huge mix of notepads and Word docs, which can become quite confusing because I have no way of keeping track of what's in my notepad or what brilliant idea was in which notepad. So it's all very hand to mouth. When I came to revising the book, as I said, I'd written the book in these alternating chapters, and I had written them pretty much in order. So when I'd finished a John chapter, I started a Henry chapter, and vice versa. And it was only in this final year of revision that I, for the first time, broke these chapters apart and put all of my Henry chapters and all of my John chapters in separate Word documents and sort of treated them as continuous narratives. So having thought a lot about how they alternated, only at that late stage did I try and see them in progression and try and track, maybe that's because why I'm interested in character and plot in a more theoretical way now, because I felt that I'd approached it differently last time. I was always concerned about interplay rather than in terms of progression. That I only did that in that final year. I really paid attention to how these characters were developing over time, and also then that allowed me to look at the subsidiary characters, the lovers, the friends. It allowed me to concentrate more on what they were doing in the plot. It was easy to lose sight of exactly what their own function in the plot was, and so that was very helpful. And then once I'd gone through those two arcs, I then put them back together again, and then had a novel again that I could then look at as a whole. And then I had a separate period of thinking about it as a whole again.
How many years did you spend working on The New Life?
It feels like it felt like a lifetime, because in one way it was a decade. I had the idea in about 2013 and the book came out in 2023, but I only started writing the book in 2017. So it was about 4 years of solid writing up until the point when I sold the book in the spring of 2021. And then there was another 2 years before the book came out, and I was working on the book, editing it, rewriting it, revising it, right up until November 2022. So until the very last moment, it was still something I was shaping under my hands.
Yeah, and I heard you saying, and one of the other podcasts that I've listened to featuring you, you were saying that you had terrible anxiety in the run-up to the book coming out. Would you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, it was a really strange thing. I mean, I've always been an anxious person, and certainly in my 20s had a lot of problems with anxiety, and which I'd largely conquered in my 30s. And I think there was just this moment where, you know, 10 years of effort one way or another, this very intense 6 years of writing essentially had all come to a head. And as I say, it was this lifetime ambition, so it felt like everything I'd always wanted had happened, and it was wonderful and perfect, and I was so excited. And often my anxiety takes this kind of form of doom and gloom and trying to think of the big catastrophe again, which is very common, the catastrophe around the corner. And I think it was something about the book finally coming out that just made me intensely vulnerable to this feeling of impending catastrophe. And I just became really, I mean, there's only a few times in my life I felt really, really threatened almost by my kind of mental health. And I felt very, 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 very stressed, very, yeah. very worry that something was going to go wrong. Somehow I was going to lose this moment. I was going to, it was all going to go up in smoke, and some, I was going to, yeah, lose control at the very last moment. And that was terrible. And oddly, the minute the book, or not oddly, the minute the book came out, it all went away again. You know,
did you feel immediately better?
Almost immediate relief, like puncturing a balloon. It just sort of hissed out of me, and I was normal again. And I did read the writer Eleanor Cadden saying something similar about when she was writing The Luminaries, that she became absolutely fixated on the idea she was going to die before this book had been published that she'd been working on so intensely. And it was something, it was similar for me. It was that sense of this absolute dread that I was going to lose this moment.
Mm-hmm.
But luckily, I was able to enjoy it in the end.
Good. Yeah, I find that's very relatable. My book's coming out in November, and people keep saying, oh, you must be so excited. And I'm sure I will be, but I don't feel excited now. I think I felt excited when I'd just finished writing the book, and I felt excited when I got the book deal. But now it's like 9 months since I finished writing the book, and now it's just like getting ready for it to come out. I just feel weird. It's just a really weird feeling. Mm. Yeah.
I think something that I couldn't quite have expected, though maybe I should have done, because I felt something similar with LRB pieces once they'd been published, was the way that when the book became a book, even though it was the summation of my ambition and all this hard work, and I found that as the months passed, it became more and more distant from me, that I felt this odd feeling that I'd lost the book, and I'd lost the sense of the person who had created the book. I'd lost that incredibly raw and sort of bloody connection to this thing. You know, something wonderful would happen with the book, some great review or win a prize, and it was wonderful. But I always felt, oh, I wish I could tell the Tom who wrote the book.
Yeah.
Because this Tom, somehow he's become used to the idea that he has a book in the world, whereas the Tom that you know, before he got his book deal, was so excited and so kind of on a knife edge about this thing, and he would have really loved this moment.
Yeah.
And no one really warns you that that's going to happen. Maybe it's something about the book becoming an object. It's a necessary aspect of that. It's just no longer your word doc. It's a physical thing. It's already asserting its independent life, and it's absorbed in, you know, capitalism, basically. it's been objectified.
Yeah. Is the new book also historical fiction, essentially, if you don't mind me calling the new life historical fiction, which your face suggests you do?
I do hate the phrase.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I hate the phrase historical fiction. It's set in the early 19th century.
Okay.
Yeah, that's all I'm saying.
Well, let me put it this way then. Let me rephrase it to try and claw back the good feeling in the room. although your book is, the new life is, as you said, fictional, like imaginary series of events with just the Oscar Wilde trial as the sort of factual linchpin in it. But it is based in a very particular historical context, a very particular moment in London at the end of the 19th century, when there was this movement, this progressive movement that ended up kind of falling apart a bit around sort of all kinds of things, sexuality, gender roles, relationships. A lot has been said about the sex scenes in The New Life. And I think when you write sex scenes in a novel, I mean, they always get a lot of comment. I think perhaps especially in literary fiction, maybe people are a bit less, find them a bit less notable in more commercial fiction. I don't know. For you, what is the purpose of a sex scene in fiction?
I think it's a sort of cliche thing, isn't it, that people say about films, and is a sex scene there to advance plot or advance character and advance sense of relationships between characters, or is it there just as a kind of a sort of tawdry bit of titillation. And I think that's probably too stark a contrast. But part of my argument would be that sex in a novel is like everything else in a novel. It has to be described well. You have to get the description right. You have to find the right register, the right pace, the right tone. And you can describe people walking along a riverbank. I think you need just basically the same skills as to describe them having sex on that riverbank. But yeah, it needs to be there for a purpose. I mean, there's like everything in a novel. As long as you know why it's there, then it should be there. And in my case, the book needed to have a lot of sex because it was a book about sexuality. It was about the way in which the body pushed up against, the needs of the body pushed up against a social reality which wasn't necessarily interested in those needs or was actively repressing them or punishing them. So for me, I had no hesitation about putting the sex in, and in a way was quite surprised that the sex got so much attention, because it feels like people have been writing, you know, like Philip Roth and John Updike, and, you know, people have been doing explicit sex scenes at least since the 60s. So I found it interesting, and it made me think it was something about the 19th century, that people's sense of the 19th century, of Victorians, was being challenged, that they just didn't expect sex in a novel set in the 1890s.
Yeah. But I think it also, in a way, that was why it was important to include, and because it really grounds the novel immediately in sort of flesh and blood and human beings. And without that, it could have been a more academic book. You know, they are talking about academic ideas through a lot of that book. So I think it is really important to establish immediately that these are real people who, you know, have desire and emotion and broken hearts and all the rest of it.
Yes, I mean, I remember thinking it was just very important for the character of John not just to become kind of intellectually possessed by the idea of making the case for the legalization of homosexuality and the toleration of homosexuality, but for that intellectual awakening to be going hand in hand with a sexual awakening, to have fallen in love at the same time, and to then see how these two things interrelated, how the sexual passion, the kind of that release was also powering him along in his political and intellectual path. And the same for Henry, that his sexual issues were again closely tied up with his intellectual interests. And that, I hope, that seems to me that should hold true for almost all fiction. I mean, I do think probably fiction has in some way shied away from sort of making those connections, trying to always ground social relations in sex and the body. I think people have probably thought that it's not necessary to the plot, and it's not relevant, and it's a different kind of book, and of course that's true, and you don't need to have sex at all. But I do think any attempt to write about human life, you should at least face up to that reality. So it should be there in everything. I think it might be there in all of my books.
Is there anything that you find particularly challenging as a writer?
Sometimes I find that I don't like, or I get bored by passages where I have to just sort of move the narrative along. I like scenes. I'd say I like dialogue. I suppose I really like dialogue as part of a scene. I like characters being brought into collision. I like sparks to fly. I like to kind of move things along with some kind of confrontation or provocation, or I sometimes find myself thinking, oh God, I've really got to just, you know, and sometimes you feel like the prose can't sing in a, you know, you just have to write these paragraphs. You have to, sometimes you just have to say, then they went to X, and they spent 2 weeks there, and this is what happened, and they thought this, and you need those passages. All novels need those passages, but they're the ones that give me least pleasure to write.
Can you think of any moments in your writing life, or it might have come in your editing life, that you learnt something about good writing that has really helped in your own work?
Well, in some ways I feel that my entire reading life has shaped me as a writer. I really have always been a kind of obsessive reader, but I've always been an obsessive reader in another sense, which is that I've always had a clear idea of the things I should read or need to read, right from the time having spent a long time reading history books, I went back to reading fiction seriously. I sort of, perhaps because of this sense of having lost years reading about Napoleon or whatever, I had this strong sense that I needed to master the canon, and you know, I needed to read Lawrence or Tolstoy or Dostoevsky or whoever, and so I've kept that through my life. I suppose it's a kind of autodidact thing. I've never stopped pushing myself to master some other aspect of the canon, to know 18th century literature, to know 19th century French literature, 19th century Spanish literature, Russian, and work my way through the 20th century. And so I think it's always been an educational project for me. I've always read those books with one eye thinking, what are they doing here? Why does it work? What are the strategies here that really work? Often it's so micro. Sometimes I could look at The New Life and say, that sentence is a Joan Didion sentence, or that bit of dialogue is when I'd been reading Penelope Fitzgerald and I wanted to try this kind of slightly elusive kind of speech. So I could do that all the way through the book. But one example that leaps out to me as a kind of structural thing was, I'd been reading Lydia Davis's essays, which are actually very kind of crafty, I suppose is the right word. They really are trying to teach people how she approaches writing problems. And I was reading these essays, and I had just come up to the point in the book where I had finally reached the moment where the Oscar Wilde trial was going to burst onto the scene and disrupt everything and throw my characters into disarray. And I couldn't work out how to bring in the Wilde case just to begin with. I sort of had a sense of how the fallout might go, but how was I going to bring in Wilde? How was I going to kind of document the case happening in real time? And I was reading these Lydia Davis essays, and she said somewhere that she had done a story, or she'd been experimenting, and she'd had these questions and answers. Whether she'd written the questions and answers or she'd taken them from somewhere else, I can't remember. But she'd removed the questions and just kept the answers. And she gave some, you know, interesting remarks on what this had done for her story, or the effect it had created, that you had to kind of project backwards to discover what the question might have been. And that's what gave me the idea that how I should handle the Wilde trial was to take questions posed to Wilde by the barristers, these aggressive, homophobic questions, that if I looked at those and sort of threw them, shuffled them up and chose the ones I wanted and threw them into the text, I could then have this dynamic where these questions were resounding but without the answer. So you had this kind of onslaught of questions, and rather than having Wilde's answers, I then interspersed John's thoughts, John's memories, and I could find these nice connections between the questions that had been posed to Wilde and the events that had happened in my novel to John, and you could then see what it would be like for this man to to read the reports of the trial in the newspapers and feel them applying to his own life. So to feel those questions applying to him. Yeah. So it was a great discovery for me and a great solution to my formal problem. And it came from reading some literary criticism.
Yeah. Thinking about your writing life, what are you the most proud of?
I suppose I have to be proud of the book, because I think I had the idea such a long time ago, and I kept hold of the idea for 10 years, you know, 4 years before I wrote a single word, and I never let it go. Every now and again I would pick up a book and read something. I sort of didn't let it drop, and I eventually forced myself to start writing. And then I did so in a very disciplined way, and I remember sometimes I would sit there and think, you know, on a weekend, what am I doing? No one is asking for this book. No one cares. Maybe, is it even any good? But I did keep going, and I will never have that again, because in some ways now my writing this second novel feels in some way like my job, which creates its own anxieties and stresses. But I will never have that feeling again of, this is a really mad thing to be doing in your spare time. It's a really hard and stressful thing to have made yourself do for reasons purely of your own. And to have done that, and for it to be good, I hope, and to have fulfilled that dream and really taken a story that I felt would make a novel, and to have made it, and for people to have enjoyed it, and for it to have lived in their head after existing in my head for so long, is a really wonderful feeling.
Thank you so much to Tom Crewe for speaking to me. I just found so much of that conversation really thought-provoking. His novel is called The New Life, and I'm going to link to it in the show notes, and also to his reading of his London Review of Books essay about growing up as a big fan of wrestling, which is really worth listening to. I've been having such a nice time promoting my book, In Writing, Conversations on Inspiration, Perspiration and Creative Desperation. And I want to say a big thank you to everyone who has written to me recently about the podcast or the book, or shown up at an event, and to everyone who attended my Arvon class earlier this week. Tomorrow I'm off to the Cambridge Literary Festival to interview David Nichols, which I think sadly is sold out, but I hope to meet some podcast listeners there. And next Saturday, the 30th of November, I'll be in Birmingham at the Heath Bookshop with the wonderful novelist Anna Metcalfe, who, by the way, was also on Granter's Best of Young British Novelists list. A reminder before we go that if you want to learn new writing skills, you can start today with Curtis Brown Creative. Use the code INWRITING20 for £20 off the short online writing course of your choice. Visit curtisbrowncreative.co.uk to find out more. I'll be back with another conversation next Friday. See you then.